Thank you, Asif, and appreciate you all coming here and listening. I want to cover a two sort of major topics in the talk today, and then happy to take questions and go wherever you'd like on Iran. The first thing I want to talk about is the fact that the international sanctions system on Iran is on the verge of collapse. This October, the vast majority of international sanctions on Iran will expire. And then 2 years after that, the international sanctions system on Iran will collapse entirely and perhaps permanently. So I want to talk about sort of the history of how that's happening, the implications for what is about to occur, and how the West might stop that. And then the other issue I'll talk about is sort of history of Iran talks during the Trump administration, some of which were public, some of which were not, and then what's happened in the Biden administration, and where we're going from here. So the history is a little interesting. I think it's actually, yesterday was an interesting day. It was the 70th anniversary of Stalin's death. He had, the Soviet Union admitted he had 20 million victims under his reign of terror. But during his tenure was also the creation of the United Nations in the aftermath of World War II, trying to figure out how we could stop mass wars, mass conflicts. And so the Security Council was created with the stated mission of providing for international peace and security. The threat that was posed by Iran, starting in the nine, really starting growing in the early 2000s, was really significant. You have lots of countries that wish each other harm, but very few which have both the intentions, the resources, and the capability to actually carry that out. Most of those are members of the Security Council: Russia, China, the United States. And so when the Security Council saw that Iran was building sort of a clandestine nuclear program up to 2003, they started implementing a series of resolutions against Iran. And I don't think we appreciate today the nature of those resolutions, because they were unanimous. You had China and Russia acting in pretty strong ways against Iran. So between 2006 and 2010, the Council passed six unanimous resolutions that did a number of things. They banned Iran from enriching uranium or reprocessing uranium, from conducting any heavy water activities, from selling or buying missiles, tanks, planes, conventional weapons to and from any nation. So there was an international arms embargo on Iran. There's a travel ban on 30, 40 Iranian terrorists and nuclear scientists and about 60 companies. Again, we sort of, if we thought we could do that today, we would sort of look around and say that's a joke. That's not possible, because we know that Russia and China would act to help Iran. So we were really in a different place 15 plus years ago, but we were able, through a lot of hard work and diplomacy, to get these international restrictions on Iran on the books in a united way. Domestic policy in the United States was also pretty unified on Iran. You didn't have elements that were looking to justify or explain away Iran's behavior. The sea change was 2015 with the JCPOA. One of the things the JCPOA did with the UN restrictions is it wiped out the previous six UN Security Council resolutions on Iran and replaced it with Resolution 2231, which condenses all the restrictions, but then weakens them and then has them expire. So instead of having this prohibition on Iranian uranium enrichment and reprocessing, it basically legalized and legitimized its ability to have a nuclear program in the first place, which for a country that was the number one state sponsor of terrorism is pretty shocking that the United Nations would actually, you know, allow that to happen. As a lot of you probably know, the UN resolution also had a number of sunsets. Starting in 2020, the restriction on Iran buying and selling conventional weapons, so that's planes, tanks, weapons, machine guns, that kind of stuff, expired in October 2020. This October is the really big tranche. The asset freeze on a number of top terrorists and nuclear entities expires. The EU's arms embargo on Iran expires. The restrictions on them buying and selling ballistic missiles and drones to places like Russia expires. And the travel ban on remaining individuals ends as well. 2 years later, the resolution evaporates. And this is really significant because there will be zero international sanctions on Iran at that time. Iran can basically do whatever it likes as an equal member of the international community, not recognizing that it has threatened its neighbors. It has conducted 360 assassination plots across five continents. In the eyes of the UN and the international community, it'll be just like Switzerland for all intents and purposes. It will have no restrictions upon it. That should concern everyone, the fact that it is only 2 years away. The premise of the JCPOA, of course, was that there was going to be some behavior change, that by giving Iran these concessions, it would moderate the regime, rebuild them in, bring them into the international community and the community of nations. We know now that the opposite has happened. They've retrenched internally. They have accelerated in their nuclear program. They've superfunded their terrorist efforts. So that whole bargain really failed. There's a question now for Europe, mostly for Europe, partially for the United States, whether they're going to move at the United Nations and extend these sanctions. The silver lining about Resolution 2231 on Iran is that it contains the snapback mechanism, which allows any of the original JCPOA participants to go and snap back those international sanctions on Iran. And they can do so in a unilateral method. Basically, if one nation says we want to return the sanctions, that's the default. And the rest of the Security Council would have to unanimously pass a resolution blocking that effort. Some of you may remember the United States tried this in August 2020, and that was something that I was involved with. I'll state at the outset, I was very strongly opposed to doing this internally, not because I wanted the restrictions and sanctions on Iran to expire, but because we did so in a very tenuous legal argument. The issue was there are sort of two separate parts of the Iran deal. There's the JCPOA, and there's the UN resolution, and they're two separate and distinct legal entities. The JCPOA is not a legal, actually, it's not really a legal entity at all. It doesn't exist in any meaningful sense. It has no signatures on it. It was just a piece of paper that all the nations said that they would agree to. It was a political commitment, not a legal commitment. It wasn't ratified by any of the states. None of the parliaments ever got to vote on it in a direct sense. So you have those two legal constructs. What the JCPOA does is it has various commitments on Iranian nuclear restrictions. If they breach those limits, then the other separate document at the UN, which is a legal document, allows you to snap back your UN sanctions on Iran if Iran is violating them. So that's what we said. We said Iran was violating its commitments. We snapped back the sanctions. But Iran and actually the European countries and Russia and China all sort of cried foul and said, the United States has withdrawn from the JCPOA. You can't use a deal that you're not part of to snap back sanctions. I personally think we were in the legal right on that, but the issue is that the rest of the international community said we weren't. And so none of them actually abided by what we said we did in August and September of 2020. They all pretended that we did no snapback and that all the sanctions on Iran still were going to expire. This has become a pretty touchy point in Europe these days because Iran is using that leverage right now to wreak havoc across Europe. We know they have been sending hundreds of suicide drones to Russia for their war against Ukraine. We also know now that Iran has conducted kidnapping assassination plots against 15 journalists in the United Kingdom. They kidnapped and held hostage probably about a dozen other European citizens inside who were in Iran. They've sentenced several of them to death. So Iran is kind of in the last, especially in the last 6 months, has effectively waged open warfare against Europe. And Europe hasn't responded to it in any meaningful sense, mostly because there's still this sort of obsession with the idea of preserving the JCPOA. Now I want to go a little bit back into what we were looking at doing in the Trump administration, where we succeeded, where we failed, and what the Biden administration has done. So the issue, the primary issue that the Trump administration saw with the deal was, again, these sunsets, the fact that time was on Iran's hand. As time went on, they would have more freedom to do what they want, and we had less leverage to enact on Iran. A lot of proponents of the JCPOA sort of say, hey, we were able to put Iran's nuclear program in a box until 2030. That was a good thing. We weren't going to be on the brink of a nuclear weapon. And the Trump administration looked at it and said, sure, but in those 15 years until 2030, Iran is just going to have an economy unshackled from any restrictions, any sanctions. And it's going to use those funds to build up a military and a terror apparatus that will allow it in 2030 to wield complete leverage over the Middle East and even over the United States as well. That it would use those funds that it had to build out air defenses, military systems to prevent any attack against its nuclear program at all. And effectively what the JCPOA was doing was kicking the can down the road and causing an immense challenge and problem for future generations. And so the Trump administration said, we would rather have this fight today on our terms under a weakened and poorer Iran rather than a stronger and more powerful Iran in the future. Now, the maximum pressure campaign, which I helped sort of implement and execute, had two twin goals. The first goal was that we wanted to get Iran back to the negotiating table and conclude a comprehensive and permanent deal with Iran. Something that didn't have sunsets, something that would completely dismantle its nuclear program, but also address the whole other range of Iranian activity that we didn't like. It's terrorism, it's ballistic missile activity and research, and it's hostage taking. We have had hostages in Iran for a long time. There are dozens of British and European and Australian and other hostages in Iran, and we wanted an end to that. This goal was, it's fair to say, not met at all. Iran refused to meet with us in person. They only communicated to us through third parties. They refused to have any in-person contact with us at all. And that was the direction of the Supreme Leader himself. So on that metric, maximum pressure did not succeed. But the second, and in my view, much more important measure was goal was a large success. And that was that we sort of said, in the interim, if we can't get a deal with Iran, we want to weaken it. We want to deprive it of all the revenue it needs to conduct its terror activity, to conduct its nuclear research and program, and its regional expansion. So I think the best metric I can state is in 2018, right as we reimposed sanctions, Iran had $124 billion in foreign currency reserves. After 2.5 years of sanctions, Iran was down to $4 billion, according to the IMF. The importance of that is hard to state just how significant and massive that is. Iran had to cut its military and terror budgets by double digits in multiple years. Their GDP cratered by 5-6%. I'll give a contrast to the current Russia policy today, just to give some reference. Right before Russia invaded, it had about $650 billion in revenue in foreign currency reserves. After a year, it's down to about half of that, which is impressive and good, but not nearly enough. Russia's economy is cratered by 2.4%, but it is set to grow by 0.8% this year and another 2.4% in 2024. That's not what sanctions are supposed to do. The maximum pressure campaign strangled the Iranian economy, and it strangled their ability to fund their activity. The Russian economy has grown, and in fact, their military budget is set to increase by about 40 billion in 2023 compared to 2022. So I just want to use that as a contrast so you can sort of see the differences between, in my view, when it's successful and all-out sanctions campaign is versus when you hold back some punches. The Biden administration came in and said and looked at the problem and said, "We want to get a deal with Iran no matter what. We are willing to do whatever it takes to get back in the deal." And they said so publicly. If any of you have been shopping in the Middle East, I think if you entered any type of bazaar or store and you told the shop owner, "I must have, your most expensive product, and I'm willing to pay whatever it takes to get it," you will absolutely pay more than you should, and they're going to bilk you. And that's exactly what Iran did to the United States. Iran used immense amounts of leverage. They kept saying no every time the United States asked for something, and they basically got away with that. One of the main concessions that Iran got was that for the first year and a half of this administration, Biden imposed no new economic sanctions on Iran. They imposed a few human rights sanctions just sort of to mollify the critics, and that was it. And so I talked to you that I mentioned that Iran was down to 4 billion in currency reserves. Right now, they are set to be back up to $43 billion in foreign currency reserves at the end of this year. If you're Iran and you've gotten, a tenfold increase in your foreign currency reserves, your economy is growing again. They're growing at about 3 to 5%. Inflation's a little lower. They're having currency problems, but overall, their economy is in a much healthier position than they were during maximum pressure. You look around and you say, "We're doing pretty good. I don't think we even need a deal because we're getting everything now, without a deal, without any restrictions on us. So we don't need to make any further concessions." And so ultimately, that's one of the main reasons I think that the negotiations start falling apart. Iran milks everything it can out of the United States, and then it sort of says, "We've gotten a whole lot without doing anything." The other issue that I think the Iranian leadership starts making is they say, "We don't want to see what happened in 2018, 2019, 2020 happen again. We don't want to go back and deal with the West only for another Republican president to get elected, withdraw, and crater our economy again." In fact, the best way to ensure that doesn't happen is we don't want to have trade with the West. We don't want to have relations with the West. We want to be reliant on ourselves, and we want to look east and north, east to China, north to Russia, and their other local, their other neighbors and partners in the region. And we want that to be our future. We do not want to be reliant or even have economic relationships with Europe and the United States, because that's going to cause infiltration in our system. If a bunch of Western businessmen are coming into Tehran, that's not a good thing for our ideological purity. That's not a good thing for their ability to influence our population. We want to be isolated. We want to be isolated from the West. That's actually the best way of preserving our system. And so today, I think that it's pretty clear that the efforts to re sort of re-implement, rejoin the JCPOA are pretty much dead. Iranian negotiators have said that they don't want to do any other interim deal. The JCPOA is the only thing that they would agree to. That's what they say in public. In private, they're a little bit different. And they are sort of making the calculus that they can outlast the West and its pressure because China is going to buy all the oil that Iran needs to fill up its government coffers. And they're largely right. During the Trump administration, we brought Iranian oil exports down to about 200,000, 300,000 barrels of oil per day, down from a peak of 2.5 million barrels of oil per day. Today, they're back up halfway. They're at about 1.1 million barrels of oil exporting per day. That's about $25, $30 billion worth of annual revenue, depending on the price. And so Iran says, hey, sanctions aren't working because they're not being implemented, and we can sell the oil we need to survive. We can continue our revolutionary expansion in the West, and time's on our side. In October, we're free from internet, we're free from most international sanctions. And 2 years after that, we're free entirely. So things are looking pretty good for us. We've aligned with the Chinese and Russians, and the West can't, in their words, they can't do a damn thing. So that's the challenge where you know, the West is today. It's squandered its negotiating leverage in the form of economic pressure. It feels that we are, the West feels that we are the ones under pressure because Iran has now accumulated enough enriched uranium for about 4 nuclear weapons, and they could, in theory, enrich that in about 10 days. There's two things I like to talk about on the nuclear side that most people don't recognize. One is Iran has been, you know, within a year of a nuclear weapon for probably 15 years. And they've been within 3 months of a nuclear weapon for 2.5, 3 years. And they've been within a couple weeks for about a year now. That doesn't mean they're about to go get a nuclear weapon. If a country, you know, wants to get a nuclear weapon secretly, they act a lot more like Pakistan did in the 90s or like North Korea did in the 2000s. They hide their program. They don't tell anyone anything about it. And they suddenly break through and have a nuclear test. Iran has, every time Iran increases its nuclear enrichment, they usually do so at a big press conference in Tehran, where they invite a bunch of press, announce that they've done this. That's not what you do when you're trying to do something secretly. The reason they do that is because they're trying to negotiate, they're trying to gain negotiation strength. They want a bunch of headlines in Western papers in Europe and the United States talking about how dangerous this is and how close they are to a nuclear weapon, so that Western diplomats come in and offer them lots of negotiation concessions. So we have that enrichment side on enrichment timeline on one hand. The other thing is their weaponization timeline. And they're actually a lot further away from an actual functioning nuclear weapon than most people realize. The Israelis typically say in public that they're between 1 and 2 years away. The United States has repeatedly said, including just a couple weeks ago, they've seen zero evidence that Iran has started weaponization activities. And the CIA director, Bill Burns, recently said that there's no indication that the Supreme Leader has made the decision to pursue an actual nuclear weapon. So that's the good news is that a nuclear weapon is not on the imminent horizon. They are closer today than they were. They have a lot more leverage today than they did yesterday. I think the number one reason they haven't is the threat of military force from Israel and from the United States. They do not want their nuclear sites bombed. And as long as they believe that Israel and the United States have the political will and the military capability to take out their nuclear sites, they aren't going to want to risk that. And so the single most important thing that the West can do is keep Iran in fear that we are willing to take that nuclear strike option against them. Sorry, the strike against their nuclear program, not actual nuclear strike. That's the single most important thing we can do. And the most important thing we can do as sort of policymakers, influencers in the community is make sure that the public is aware that this is and must be a red line against Iran. Iran is a country which regularly chants death to Israel, death to the United States, death to the West. I think if there's one thing we should have learned in the last century of history, is that when dictators say something in public repeatedly, we should believe them and take them at their word. We should have believed Hitler at his word when he said he was going to wipe out the Jews. We should have believed Stalin when he said that he was going to go to war with the West, which he did. We should have believed Putin when he said Ukraine wasn't a country and that it didn't deserve to exist. And that's what we saw with in his invasion of Ukraine. And so we should absolutely take the Iranian regime at their word when they chant death to Israel and death to the United States. To not do so would, I think, be the definition of the word naive. And so we are headed into a fairly tricky next several years. I think there's the question of what we're going to have to do with Iran's nuclear program is going to be the most important question facing the U.S. administration and Europeans in the Middle East. It's probably going to fall to the next presidential term or administration to actually make that determination of whether we're going to either strike Iran ourselves or whether we will have to support a Israeli strike. And Iran is going to do everything it can to make that as painful as possible. So they pre-positioned 100,000 rockets in Lebanon, targeting Israel. They've threatened to conduct assassination campaigns of Jews across the West, across Europe, across Israel, if that happens. So this could be a very bloody situation that we're headed into, but it is something that we are headed into nonetheless. The glimmer of hope is the mass protests that have swept through Iran in the last six, seven months. I'll open up for questions now, but with one last thought on that, which is today Iran is sclerotic. It is full of corruption. The people don't trust it. The people openly in the streets of Tehran chant, and hundreds of cities across Iran chant, death to the dictator, death to the regime. This regime is not stable and it is not permanent. I liken it a lot to what the Soviet Union looked like in the 1980s. Now, I can't tell you for 1982 or 1988, 89. All I can sort of see is that those conditions are very similar to what we see at the end survey of an empire at its decline. And that's what we're seeing right now. And with that, I'll open it up to questions and comments and anything you guys want to talk about.
Great. Thank you, Gabriel, for that comprehensive overview. Depressing, obviously. We got a lot to deal with and tackle. So as Gabriel said, the floor is now open to questions. Alex, I'll let you ask the first question, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, thanks very much for, Asaf said, did he say sobering? It probably helps to be the opposite, or that's the product. You covered a lot of points. I want to go back to one thing which I've been very concerned about and I've written about a number of times. And that's the nature of the U.S. support, let's call it, for Iran. The removal of the indulgence shown by the Obama administration and now the Biden administration towards Iran. And I want to know what your thoughts are about its origins. Why, in the face of not only Israeli support, but or Israeli opposition, but opposition across the Arab world, including from critical allies in the Gulf and Saudi Arabia, why did the Obama administration launch into JCPOA? Failed to support first one street level revolution and now basically another, remove sanctions or fail to enforce sanctions and so on. What's the theory? What's the underlying concept?
So I think I'll add one more piece to that list of sort of weak policies, which is about just over a year ago, you had three of Biden's top Iran officials resign in protest because of the capitulations that the current special envoy Rob Malley was making to the Iranians. They viewed was so egregious that they had to quit the negotiation team. Two of these people were political appointees. So these were not even, and the third one was a career official who was not conservative. It's staggering, and I published a piece in Tablet which sort of lists the grievances and the capitulations which Mali made to the Iranians in pretty great detail. These top officials in the Biden administration are basically the same officials from the Obama administration. There's very little fresh blood. The only fresh blood are the ones that resigned in protest. There's a, again, to use the word naive, I think is appropriate here, view from, again, this is a small cadre of officials. This does not represent the majority of Democrat officials. When I talk to Democrats on the Hill, they have a completely different view of Iran policy than this administration has. This is, again, a small select cadre of folks who are quite radical, I think, in their view of Iran. And I'll make the case that I think and this answers why did Obama, you know, fail to see the opportunity in the Green Movement. It's because of one of the most pernicious and successful information operations conducted against the West by a foreign adversary, which is the Iranian information operation designed to weaken foreign perceptions of its threat. This has been done through groups that you are all familiar with. I'll just say there has been a lawsuit against the National Iran American Council for acting as the lobby of the regime, which was settled in favor against that group and its founder, Trita Parsi, who were some of the most influential officials in the Obama administration and to the current leadership in the Biden administration. Their top Iran officials have all spoken to this group on multiple occasions. There's a lot of personnel that are shared between there. In the Obama administration, this information operation was centered around this idea that the regime could be influenced by moderates to move to transform itself into a more moderate direction, that it could make peace with the West, which was, if any of you have read Iran's founding documents and this aims from its supreme leaders, you would know that that is complete folly. These sort of Iranian-American activists successfully convinced the Biden administration that they could actually work with them. That was the information coup of the decade. And it hasn't gotten any of the scrutiny it should. You have things, here's one example. If any of you I think it would upset any of you if one of your country's top officials was the son or daughter of Putin's top close friend, or if one of your top China policy officials was the child of Xi Jinping's close friend. That is the case in United States Iran policy. A top U.S. official is the daughter of a close friend of President Rouhani. That should concern a lot of us. That extended again into the Biden administration. In the West, we always would say, of course, there's Russian operations. There's Russian espionage, there's Russian information operations, and there's Chinese hacking and information operations and propaganda. These two administrations, the Biden administration and Obama administration, have persistently refused to acknowledge that there are Iranian information and propaganda operations. And that's, in my view, because they've successfully been influenced by them and at deep levels where where the top officials misdiagnose what Iran's intentions are and what their strategic calculus is. I don't believe that they deny what Iran's capabilities are. They don't say, hey, we don't think Iran is developing a nuclear program. But it causes officials like John Kerry to say, hey, Iran has a fatwa against developing nuclear weapons, so surely they wouldn't develop a nuclear weapon, which is strange because Iran had a secret nuclear weapons program. It leads officials like Rob Malley today to say things like, we can't do certain sanctions because it will provoke Iran. I think that's what caused us to lose deterrence against Russia, was this idea that if we give certain weapons to Ukraine, it will cause Russia to invade. And we saw that the weakness is actually what provoked Putin. And it's the weakness that provokes the Iranians now into conducting serious assassination campaigns against many of my former colleagues and coworkers and friends today.
Great, thank you. Alex, we'll come back to you, but let me go to the audience, if that's okay.
Sure, please.
Great, so Gabriel, so our friend Nevitt from Seattle was asking, what is stopping the European partners from snapping back international sanctions as outlined in the JCPOA, given, you know, obviously Tehran's repeated blatant violations of its commitments?
So there's a belief in Europe, which I will again ascribe to really smart Iranian information operations, that if Europe snaps back these sanctions, it will provoke Iran into doing two things. One, going to 90% enrichment, and two, withdrawing from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it is already serially violating and has been for several years. And then three, that it would provoke Iran into sort of escalating its regional aggression and terror campaigns. So that's where, when I talk to European officials, that's what I always ask them, why haven't you snapped back? And they give me some variation on this answer. The issue is that's caving to Iranian propaganda, for lack of a better term. The idea that if you put pressure on them, then it will cause them to do something you don't like. That's what foreign adversaries will always do and say to ensure that they don't get pressure placed upon them. And if you give into that mindset, you've lost the battle already. So that's where the Europeans are, unfortunately. We're working, many of us are working to try to change their thinking on it, but that's where it stands today.
Great, thank you. Going on to our friend and colleague, Ref, is asking, I know you mentioned this in your remarks, but, you know, just to clarify that, he's asking about, you know, whether or not Iran would want to enter the JCPOA to close off the possible strike against its facilities by Israel, given that the E3+1 will protect them until the sunset clauses have expired. So, I mean, are they actively, obviously, pushing that?
So they used to very much want the United States to go back to the JCPOA. That was something that they very much wanted in 2018, 2019, 2020. I think today there are elements within the regime which want the West to go back to the JCPOA and want to go back there so they can sort of buy a little bit more time and prevent an Iranian strike. But I think the Supreme Leader himself and some of his close cadres aren't that concerned about an Israeli strike, and they just don't really want to play ball with the West, and they don't want to go back in the JCPOA anymore. If they wanted to go back in the JCPOA, they would have made all concessions necessary to do so. Really, they kind of just made excuses after excuses last year to hold things up and delay things, as well as in 2021. I think part of that was their calculus that they can get more out of the West. But I think now they will have a wholesale change in strategic thinking, and they just don't want to tie their fortunes to the JCPOA. They don't want to be bound by international agreements. They'd rather go solo. And they think that they can provide a significant enough threat to Israel and Israeli interests and security that they can prevent that Israeli strike. That's something that folks in Israel should be concerned about and should think about what they're messaging to Iran, so the Iranians don't get confused about Israeli complacency. That I think would be something I would be focusing a lot if I were an Israeli official.
Great. Thank you for that. Let me try to combine these two questions here. One from David, who's asking, how vulnerable are the actual nuclear facilities in Iran, and what kind of reaction should we expect from the Iranian people? And really, you know, to that end, you know, the kind of the fragmentation and factions inside of Iran. And Michael is asking, you know, in that same kind of constellation, what is the alternative to the military strike? I mean, you know, what, you know, and can the U.S. quarantine them, you know, block oil shipments and whatnot? So if you want to tackle those two questions, that'll be great.
Those are phenomenal questions. So one on how hard is it to strike Iranian facilities? You know, to the extent that I can answer this in the public setting, they are fortified, but I would on any day bet that U.S. munitions and aircraft can, if necessary, defeat and destroy those Iranian nuclear facilities. That does not mean it will be easy. It does not mean that there would not be loss of U.S. planes or Israeli planes in the process, but I'm confident that we could destroy Iranian facilities. There's two interesting questions. What happens, and I think this is what the Israelis and us think a lot about, is, okay, that's one thing, we can do that. What happens the day after, the hour after? One is going to be what happens at Iran. The loss, if, you know, I guess part of this is, think, if you are a fragile government and you just have your crown military jewels destroyed in a raid by your greatest enemies, it does two things. One, it signals that you're pretty weak if you can't even defend your sovereign territory against your sworn enemies. So on one side, it's going to empower your domestic opponents and sort of say, hey, you guys can protect our borders. What business do you have protecting and governing the country? On the other hand, you're also going to, you know, do the rally around the flag effect for certain domestic audiences. It's unclear to me exactly how that would shake out. Right now, I hear daily from scores of Iranians saying, why won't the United States come and basically impose regime change on Iran? Why can't you blow up Iranian security facilities? And I have to say, hey guys, you know, there's no political appetite for that in the United States. That will never, there won't ever be sort of regime change for the sake of regime change as part of U.S. policy. So I do think that you might see some happiness among Iranians if this happened, but I don't want to overstate how much that would happen. What was the second question? I kind of forgot about.
The question related to you spoke about the vulnerability or the reaction of the people as far as fragmentation.
And the second question was, how can we prevent this outcome? Right. Look, a lot of when President Trump withdrew from the deal, there were hundreds of pundits saying the alternative to the deal is war. And now we're going to have nuclear confrontation. That was almost 6 years ago. Sorry, that was almost five years ago that we've been out of this deal, and there's been no war. And there's no war on the imminent horizon. Why? Because neither country wants war. Neither government wants war. Neither public wants war. Both nations will do everything they can to forestall that outcome. Israel doesn't want war either. And that's really a good thing. The dangerous thing is if you allow the fear of war to prevent you from doing the difficult but necessary things. So the reason we haven't had war and the reason we haven't had an Iranian nuclear weapon is because there's been really strong signals from the U.S. in the Department of Defense that we're willing to, that we have red lines and that Israel has red lines. And if they cross them, we're willing to take military action. To me, that is the essence. Is the most important thing to maintain and the dangerous thing to lose. We lost deterrence at times in the Trump administration when Iran thought it could do things and have zero response. So when Iran shot down an American UAV over the Strait of Hormuz, which was international airspace in summer 2019, President Trump made the decision not to respond. The Iranians thought that that meant they could take pot shots at Americans and kill Americans with impunity. That kind of escalated through the fall until when the Iranians stormed, Iranian militias stormed the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, and they were trying to basically recreate what they did to the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979. That was because they thought that American deterrence didn't exist, and that we weren't willing to defend ourselves. President Trump and the military ultimately Qasem Soleimani in response. That was when the Iranians realized, oh, the Americans are serious about deterrence, and we actually can't mess with them. And so for the rest of 2020, we were pretty good in terms of managing threats from Iran because they realized we were serious. I would say the most dangerous thing is when Iran thinks that they're in that situation again where they can get away with things. My view is that's where we are today, not on the nuclear front, but on the assassination front. They've made several, and some of these are not public, assassination attempts against top U.S. officials. And they keep doing so because they think they can get away with it and that there aren't consequences. And that's because there haven't been consequences yet. So I'd say we actually are in a state of failed deterrence on Iran, not on the nuclear front right now, but on the domestic terror front.
Right. So let me ask you a question, Gabriel, that I've been thinking about. So you haven't, touched on in your remarks yet. The factor of what's happening in the region as far as the Abraham Accords, Israel's reach over, overtures to Saudi Arabia, those ties, the fact that, of course, the regime itself is a direct threat onto Mecca. I mean, are those adding, to your points about the deterrence as regarding to when it comes to Israel's ability, as far as how the Iran perceives all of this? I mean, can you just talk a little bit about that as well?
I would say that if the award for who gets credit for the Abraham Accords would probably go to two people in my view would be Jared Kushner and Yusuf Al-Attiyah, the Emirati ambassador to the U.S. I would say obviously President Netanyahu and President Trump also get credit, but the award for best supporting actor in my view goes to the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei himself. He's the single most important person for the Abraham Accords. For creating the strategic conditions which forced and let Israel and the Arab nations come together because they were sick and tired of being condescended to and threatened by Iran. And Arab countries looked around and said, hey, you know who's really doing our work for us is Israel. They are infiltrating Iran. I don't think it's any secret that they are blowing up things inside Iran. Taking out Iranian nuclear scientists. And we actually have a lot more in common with them than we have against them. In Iran's strategic calculus, this is the most dangerous thing because it was counting on unified Arab opposition to an Israeli strike on its nuclear facilities. It was counting that if it chose to go to war with Israel, that it would at least have some international sympathy, and especially from its Arab neighbors. With the Abraham Accords in place, the opposite is the case. It is you now have a united front against Iran. You have significant numbers of working groups at the public and non-public level working on things like ballistic missile defense, things like maritime security, energy security, cyber security, all of which are very clearly focused on addressing and neutralizing the Iranian threat. If Israel and Saudi Arabia make peace, that's again a major, major blow to Iran because it's your two greatest regional rivals coming together. And they're going to be coming together largely to unify against Iran and Iranian threats. So Iran's sort of regional policy has always been to create this Shia crescent. So if you look at the map, it's this crescent from Iran to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, all the way into the Mediterranean, and then coming around with Yemen. Their goal is to destabilize Sunni states, create proxies and vassal states in the Middle East. But with Israel and the Arab states united, they're going to be strengthening their own governments and fighting against Iranian proxy groups. I think Iran got away with a lot of things from in the 2000s and teens of their ability to undermine and attack Arab states and Israel and kind of get away with it. And now that they're uniting a lot more in strategic frameworks, it's not getting away with it all. So yes, this is, I think the Abraham Accords is one of the most, you know, one of the greatest weaknesses that the Iranian regime has on the macro scale. Its benefit is that China and Russia are coming to its rescue politically and economically, but it's lost its region.
Great, thank you for that. So let's keep an eye on the clock here. Let me try to give Alex the last question as we come to a close this afternoon. Alex, go ahead.
Sure. I want to ask about something that's bothered me for a long time, and I'm not sure that you can or perhaps want to answer it. And that's divisions within the United States government itself, and that there seems to be a very clear disagreement, one might say, between the Defense Department, which is constantly enhancing its cooperation, particularly with Israel, but also with the Gulf states and exercises and so on. The intelligence community, which we have very limited ways of determining what they're doing and whose side they are on, so to speak, and the State Department. And the State Department, which seems to an outsider to have been led around by the nose by this special representative, Robert Malley, who seems to be an independent running Iran policy, obviously with some sort of supervision, but who knows what. And what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, on Malley himself, I'm always cautious because I worked for his predecessors, and sometimes we would see these accusations in various formats that, oh, we were running rogue policy that Pompeo didn't know about and that Trump didn't know about. And that wasn't the case. It was actually the case that everything was being directed pretty rigorously by Pompeo himself. And I suspect that's the case today, that Blinken and Malley are working pretty hand in hand. I do believe that Malley shouldn't be there anymore. It's not necessarily because he's implementing this policy, which I actually think is Blinken's policy. It's that he's lost the confidence, both the Iranian people who don't respect him, and he has lost fear of the Iranian regime, which ought to fear him. And that's a fatal combination for doing his job properly. That being said, yes, it is the State Department which is off on its own wild fantasy island. And much of the rest of the U.S. government is actually either career folks who have fought for decades against the Islamic Republic, who are sort of very confused about what's happened at state. When I look at folks and talk to folks at the Department of Justice, they are firmly still in their mission of fighting against Iranian influence and activities in the states. The Department of Defense is, again, much stronger than the Department. Even the NSC has a lot of people who were aghast at the negotiations and what was happening there and thought it was completely insane. So you are correct. It is the State Department which is off on its own strange little adventure. They don't have buy-in from the rest of government, even though they are the ones in the lead. I think, you know, CENTCOM is in a really good position. They were led with phenomenal leadership by General Frank McKenzie, who retired quite recently. His successor, I think, is doing a good job sending the right signals to Iran of deterrence, working closely with the Israelis. And so I think we are, you know, I think we can have pretty strong faith and trust in the government writ large as an institution when it comes to Iran. And the failures in leadership are at the State Department, and primarily and severely at the State Department itself, which is wildly antagonistic towards Israel, and not very antagonistic at all towards Iran, which is the opposite of what it should be.
Great. Gabriel, really, I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. I want to thank Alex, as always, for joining me. And of course, thank everybody who joined us this afternoon. Obviously, you've covered a great deal of detailed material, and there's a lot to discuss. So hopefully you can also come back as things continue to evolve and progress on a daily basis. And obviously, I look forward to getting together in person at some point. But really, thank you again for everything. And I thank everybody this afternoon for joining us. Be on the lookout for future webinars. And I hope everybody has a good day.
Thanks, everyone. Appreciate you.